A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Here's what Daniel sent us. Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu will hold his first meeting with President Trump in 5 months tomorrow. While in the U.S., he'll attend a memorial to the late Senator Lindsey Graham. This visit is being cast as a somewhat impromptu meeting to discuss urgent matters related to the murky war with Iran. Unusually, Prime Minister Netanyahu took off from an Israeli Air Force base rather than Ben-Gurion Airport, citing security concerns and dispensing with the practice of allowing the press to participate in the trip. He goes on, I thought this would be a good jumping-off point to discuss an important question in international relations and the inner workings of government and power, which is how the day-to-day engagements of heads of state are actually planned. It's hard to imagine that a bilateral meeting of this magnitude could be really in any way impromptu. But if it were truly that, what's the minimum lead time that a competent intergovernment working group could actually adhere to in pulling this off? And these periodic high-stakes bilaterals aside, how much negotiation and planning goes into scheduling any given day in the life of a head of state?
Oh, this is a great one. The thing that jumps out at me immediately is that word, impromptu. It's doing an enormous amount of work here, and most of it's diplomatic theater.
Right. You hear impromptu summit, and the mental image is two leaders suddenly realizing they need to talk and clearing their calendars. Which is not how any of this works.
Not even slightly. And the details in Daniel's prompt are already telling us the real story. Nevatim Air Base instead of Ben-Gurion. No press. Confirmed at a White House correspondents' dinner of all places, 3 days before the meeting. Every single one of those choices is a signal.
So, let's start with what we actually know about this specific meeting. It's the eighth between Netanyahu and Trump since the second term began, more than any other foreign leader. Netanyahu himself noted that, called it a great privilege and a great responsibility. The public agenda is Iran's nuclear program, expanding the Abraham Accords, and attending Lindsey Graham's memorial. Graham died July 12th after a sudden illness.
And the backdrop is this five-month war with Iran that everyone keeps calling murky. Which is a word that's doing its own kind of work. Murky means the public doesn't know the full scope, the objectives aren't clearly stated, and the endpoint isn't defined.
Trump gave an interview to Axios the same day Netanyahu departed, saying the U.S. is in very deep talks with Iran and will go back to very strong military action if negotiations fail. So the meeting is happening against an active conflict with a diplomatic off-ramp that may or may not exist.
And here's the thing. To understand whether this meeting could really be impromptu, we first need to understand how a head of state's day is actually built. Because the answer to Daniel's question about minimum lead time is going to make a lot more sense once you see the machinery.
Walk me through it. What does the advanced team model actually look like?
For any presidential event outside the White House, an advanced team deploys days or weeks ahead. And it's not one team, it's five parallel tracks running simultaneously. Track one is diplomatic clearance and agenda setting, run through the State Department and the National Security Council. Track 2 is the Security Advance, Secret Service, plus Host Country Security. Track 3 is Communications, Press Logistics, Pool Arrangements, Photo Opportunities. Track 4 is Medical. They need to know which hospital they're going to, if something happens, who the surgeons are, how long the drive is. Track 5 is Transportation and Logistics, the motorcade routes, the helicopter landing zones, the backup vehicles.
5 tracks. And every single one of them has to be completed before the principal arrives.
Completed, rehearsed, and contingency planned. The Secret Service requires every location pre-surveyed, every route pre-driven, every movement with a fallback. This is what they call the protective bubble. And it's the single biggest determinant of a head of state's schedule. You can't decide to stop for coffee, you can't see an interesting shop and pull over. Every single 5-minute block of the day has been mapped, surveyed, and secured before you get there.
So, the impromptu diner visit you sometimes see in campaign coverage.
Hours of advance work minimum. The advance team got there before the candidate did, swept the place, positioned agents, established communications. The candidate walking in and seeming spontaneous is the final 2% of a process that started hours earlier.
That's the American side. What about the Israeli side? Daniel mentioned the departure from Nevatim, which is an Air Force base, not a civilian airport.
The Prime Minister's office has its own scheduling apparatus. You've got the Director General of the PMO, the Military Secretary, who's a senior IDF officer, and the Prime Minister's Chief of Staff. The Military Secretary coordinates all security aspects of travel. And here's the key detail. Shifting the departure to Nevatim Air Base means the entire logistics chain moved from civilian to military control. The standard protocol office at Ben Gurion, the civilian ground handlers, the press pool arrangements, all of that was bypassed.
And they flew on Wing of Zion, the modified 767.
Which is maintained by the Israeli Air Force's Wing of Zion squadron. Using it requires coordination between the PMO, the IAF, and the security services. So you've got a military aircraft departing from a military base with no press. The entire departure was a security operation, not a diplomatic one.
Which is itself a signal. A prime minister leaving from an Air Force base during an act of war is visually different from a prime minister leaving from the civilian airport with the press waving goodbye.
Exactly the point. Now, the daily schedule, what insiders call the grid, ahead of state's day is built minute by minute. Travel time between locations, security buffers, what they call windshield time for briefings in the car, meal periods, family time, rest, every 5-minute block is accounted for. And the grid is negotiated between multiple offices, the host scheduling team and the guests, the respective security services, the communications teams, the policy teams who need to prepare briefing books and talking points, and the protocol offices who handle seating arrangements and forms of address.
The protocol pod sounds tedious, but it's genuinely important. Getting a title wrong or seating someone in the wrong position can cause a diplomatic incident.
It's caused diplomatic incidents. There are entire books written about protocol mistakes that derailed meetings before they started.
So you've got this incredibly complex machine. And then you introduce what you might call the two-body problem.
Right. When two heads of state meet, the complexity multiplies. Each leader's security detail has to coordinate with the others. The host's schedule has to accommodate the guest's time zone. Israel is 7 hours ahead of Washington. The guest's domestic political obligations don't pause. In this case, Likud held internal elections on July 27th, the same day Netanyahu departed.
Wait. He left the country on the day his party was holding internal elections.
He did, which is a choice. It means he's either supremely confident in the outcome, or he's decided that appearing as a statesman on the world stage is more valuable than being present for party machinery.
Or both. And the impromptu framing helps sell that. He's not skipping party elections for a long-planned trip. He's responding to an urgent national security situation that only he can handle.
That's the domestic political dimension, and it's baked right into the scheduling. So now that we understand the machinery, let's ask the question Daniel actually posed. What's the minimum lead time for a truly impromptu bilateral meeting?
And the public notification window here was roughly 72 hours. Trump confirmed the visit on Saturday, July 25th, for a Tuesday, July 28th meeting.
72 hours is what the public saw. The actual planning almost certainly began earlier. The fact that Netanyahu's office had already confirmed the trip before Trump's public announcement means back-channel coordination was happening days or even a week prior. You don't get to a public announcement without the advance teams already moving.
So what can you actually do in 24 to 48 hours if you needed to?
A minimum viable bilateral meeting is possible in that window if several conditions are met. First, the leaders have an established direct secure communication channel, which these two do. This is their eighth meeting. Second, the agenda is narrowly focused on an ongoing crisis, Iran in this case. You're not negotiating a trade deal from scratch, you're updating on an act of conflict. Third, the venue is a pre-cleared location. The White House is always hot. It's the most secure, most pre-surveyed building in the country. You don't need to do a site survey because it's been done continuously for decades. Fourth, the visiting leader's security apparatus already has liaison relationships with the host country. Shin Bet and Secret Service have worked together many times.
And what can't be compressed?
Full intelligence briefings. Those take time to prepare, vet, and translate. Detailed policy papers with interagency coordination across multiple departments. Translation services for formal sessions if you need them. Ceremonial elements. If you're doing a state dinner, that's months of planning. Joint press conference logistics. The press pool, the camera positions, the simultaneous translation feeds. The full motorcade package. Route surveys, identifying hospital stops along the route, helicopter landing zones. All of that typically requires 2 to 4 weeks minimum.
So what we're seeing is a stripped-down meeting. No state dinner, no joint press conference, no ceremonial elements. Just the core. Two leaders in a room at the White House focused on a single crisis.
And that's exactly what you'd expect from something framed as urgent. But here's where it gets interesting. The impromptu label itself may be a deliberate diplomatic signal to Iran.
Say more.
Think about what it communicates to Tehran. Trump and Netanyahu are in such close coordination that they can convene at a moment's notice. Decisions about the next phase of the war could be made at any time, without the long lead times that would normally telegraph intentions. The short public notice window keeps adversaries guessing. By the time Iran's intelligence services process that the meeting is happening, the decisions may already be made.
So the label is part of the message. Impromptu? Isn't a description of the planning process. It's a signal of operational tempo.
And the choice of Nevatim Air Base serves multiple purposes simultaneously. Genuine security concerns. Israel is at war, and a civilian airport is a softer target. A signal of seriousness to domestic audiences. This is a wartime prime minister on a wartime mission, not a politician on a diplomatic junket. And the absence of press means the government controls the narrative entirely. No pool reporters filing stories about who looked tired or who seemed tense. The only images the public sees are the ones the PMO chooses to release.
The visual of a prime minister boarding Wing of Zion at an Air Force base is fundamentally different from the visual of a prime minister walking through a civilian terminal. One says crisis, the other says routine.
And then there's the Lindsey Graham funeral, which is doing several things at once.
Graham was a staunch Israel ally. The visit is meaningful.
But the timing is also convenient. The funeral provides what you might call a B agenda. It softens the appearance of a crisis summit. Netanyahu isn't just flying to Washington because the Iran situation is deteriorating. He's also paying respects to a friend. It gives the trip a human dimension that makes the urgency feel less alarming.
It's diplomatic cover. Not in a cynical way. I'm sure the sentiment is real, but in a functional way. The funeral provides a publicly legible reason for the trip that doesn't involve saying, we need to decide whether to escalate the war.
That's exactly the kind of thing that gets negotiated in the scheduling process. The policy teams on both sides are asking, what does this meeting look like to the outside world? What story does the timing tell? What story does the venue tell? What story does the guest list tell?
The meeting itself hasn't happened yet. It's scheduled for tomorrow. But the scheduling decisions have already communicated volumes. The 72-hour notice. The military departure. The press blackout. The funeral. Every single one of those is a sentence in a paragraph that the public and adversaries are both reading.
Let me give you a concrete sense of what the grid for a day like this actually looks like. The president's schedule is built backward from the meeting time. If the bilateral is at 11 in the morning, you work backward. The president needs to be briefed by his national security team, so that's a 45-minute block starting at 10. Before that, he needs to receive the latest intelligence update, which might be a 15-minute read followed by a 10-minute verbal briefing. Before that, he's had breakfast, reviewed the overnight developments, maybe taken a call with a domestic advisor. Every block is accounted for.
On the Israeli side, Netanyahu's just gotten off a 10 to 12-hour flight. He's 7 time zones ahead. His body thinks it's evening when he's walking into a morning meeting.
Which is why the host's scheduling team has to build in rest periods. You don't put a jet-lagged leader into a high-stakes negotiation without giving them time to recover. That means the visiting delegation arrives the day before, even if the public only hears about the meeting day of. The grid accounts for recovery time, prep time, and contingency time.
The 72 hours the public sees. Saturday announcement. Tuesday meeting. That's the visible tip of a much larger operation.
The back-channel coordination probably started at least a week prior, possibly longer given that the Iran war has been ongoing for 5 months, and these two have met 7 times already. The institutional machinery is well-oiled. The NSC and the Israeli PMO have established workflows. The security services have existing liaison protocols. You're not building anything from scratch.
Which means the minimum lead time question depends heavily on the relationship. An 8th meeting between close allies with an active crisis is very different from a first meeting between new leaders who've never worked together.
For a first meeting, you're looking at months. For this, a crisis meeting between leaders whose teams have done this 7 times before, you can compress dramatically. But you're still not getting below 24 hours, and even that's pushing it hard. The flight alone is half a day. You can't teleport a prime minister to Washington.
Let's talk about what most coverage gets wrong, because I think there are a few layers here.
The biggest one is taking the public notification window as the actual planning timeline. When a news report says the meeting was arranged in 3 days, what they mean is the public was told 3 days in advance. The machinery was already spinning well before that.
The second thing is assuming that a head of state schedule is flexible. It's the least flexible schedule in the world. The protective bubble means every movement is pre-planned. Spontaneity is a luxury that security apparatuses don't permit.
The third, this is the one that really matters for understanding international relations, is missing the signaling function of scheduling decisions. Who meets when, where, with how much notice, with what level of ceremony? These aren't logistical details. They're diplomatic communications. A working visit at the White House means something different from a state dinner. A 3-day notice means something different from a 3-month notice. A military departure means something different from a civilian one.
This scheduling is the message, or at least part of it.
Once you start reading it that way, you see it everywhere. When two leaders meet at a summit but only have a brief pull aside rather than a formal bilateral, that's a signal. When a visit that was supposed to be 3 days gets cut to 1, that's a signal. When the press is excluded, that's a signal.
In this case, excluding the press also means no one files stories about the mood in the delegation. No one photographs who's traveling with the prime minister. No one reports on offhand comments made in the hallway. The information environment is entirely controlled.
Which brings us back to the domestic dimension. Netanyahu is in an election campaign. The trip allows him to appear as the indispensable statesman while his rivals are campaigning at home. The impromptu framing reinforces that only he can handle the big issues. Only he gets the call from the White House. Only he flies out on short notice to manage the most consequential relationship Israel has.
The reality is that the trip was probably in discussion for at least a week, possibly longer. The impromptu label is, what would you call it?
A diplomatic fiction that serves both leaders' needs. Trump gets to look decisive and responsive. He can summon allies at a moment's notice when the situation demands it. Netanyahu gets to look indispensable. Iran gets the message that the U.S.-Israel axis can move faster than they can react. Everyone gets something from the framing.
Except maybe the scheduling teams who actually had to pull this together in compressed time.
Those people are exhausted, and nobody will ever know their names. That's the hidden architecture we're talking about. The advance teams, the security surveyors, the communications officers, the protocol staff, they're the ones who make the grid work, and their work is invisible by design. If they do their job perfectly, you never know they existed.
What should someone take away from all this if they're reading the news tomorrow and seeing the coverage of the meeting?
3 things. First, when you hear impromptu summit, ask yourself what diplomatic signal is being sent by that framing. The label itself is part of the message. Second, the next time you see a head of state's public schedule, remember the invisible infrastructure that makes each 5-minute block possible. The advanced teams, the security surveys, the grids. Third, pay attention to the logistics as much as the policy. The scheduling decisions often reveal more about the relationship than the official statements.
The where and the when and the how much notice. Those are primary sources. You don't need a leaked memo to know something is urgent if the meeting was arranged in 3 days, with no press and a military departure.
The machinery of state isn't boring bureaucracy. It's the hidden architecture that makes high-stakes diplomacy possible. Understanding it gives you a much richer picture of what's really going on.
Which leaves us with one final question to chew on. What happens when the machinery breaks down? What does a truly failed coordination look like?
Oh, that's a whole other episode. But the short version is motorcade routes that don't match, security details that haven't been briefed on each other's rules of engagement, protocol mistakes that consume the first hour of a meeting, leaders arriving to venues that haven't been swept.
A scheduling error at this level isn't an inconvenience. It's a security incident.
The fact that we almost never see those failures is a testament to how good these teams are. The protective bubble works, the grids hold, the machinery is quiet and competent and almost entirely invisible.
As the Iran situation develops, watch for the scheduling signals, the notice periods, the departure locations, the press access. They'll tell you how urgent things really are, sometimes before the official statements do.
Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop.
This has been My Weird Prompts. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave a review. It helps other curious minds find the show.
We'll be back soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.